flashes, huh? What's your favorite scary movie?
not that one.
And welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking, I sure do admire people who do things. We're talking about, I took a bottle yesterday, a whole fifth. And we're talking, from what I've heard, she pursued it in all directions. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and we're talking, well, I do hope you've forgotten about that silly little plan of yours. Which one? About blowing up the White House.
Oh, boy. This dude is not well.
Aunt Clara! Oh, my God. The woman playing his mom is Aunt Clara. Were you a Bewitched watcher?
No.
Oh, God. Okay, well, she was a daffy Aunt Clara for a lot of Bewitched. And it was, anyway, everyone, we were discussing Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train. And clearly my big takeaway is that Marianne Lorne from Bewitched is in this movie.
There we go. I mean, my big takeaway was, how is the character played by Pat Hitchcock my favorite actor in this film?
Joe, oh my, I am so happy to hear you say that, because when I was logging this on Letterboxd, I almost put Pat Hitchcock as the MVP of this movie.
She totally is.
But then I finished the movie and I was like, every movie should have a carousel set piece.
Wow. You know what? Both statements can be true.
They should. But no, I was shocked because, I mean, we've seen Patty Hitchcock before. You know, she has that little like brief cameo in Psycho, but she actually has a role in this movie, mm-hmm. and she is my MVP.
She's very fun in this movie. I would have taken more of this character.
I actually think a lot of these side characters I would have taken more of. I actually enjoyed all of them.
Truly. This is a fun one.
Yeah. Was this a first time watch for you?
It was. And it was for you as well.
It was. It was. I must say, I was surprised by this. I mean, well, what Hitchcock have we done before? We've done Rope. We've done Psycho. Mm-hmm. And Rebecca.
Yes.
Yeah. Honestly, I think we're on a roll with these. And a lot of queer shit in this movie, too.
Yes, the queer shit in Hitchcock just keeps on rolling, doesn't it?
I mean, but it's like, it's all over the place here, but in front of the camera, behind the camera, and with the author of the book it's based on.
Oh, yes, yes. Maybe this is because it's a first-time watch. I didn't realize this is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel.
Her first novel, mind you.
Oh, that's right. I did know that, because Hitch definitely fleeced her.
He did. But you know what, though? Arguably, she became more famous because of this movie, so maybe it was like a long-term benefits.
Sure, we'll go with that.
Well, why don't we just jump right in? Because as with all Hitchcock movies, I feel like there's always a lot to discuss.
Oh my gosh, so much.
Okay. Just a heads up, everyone, I am pulling all of this from the making of featurette on the Blu-ray. There were a couple things on the Wikipedia page that went in line with what I was seeing on the Blu-ray, so if I saw a quote that went in line with that, I pulled it and just applied it.
Sure, okay.
So, Strangers on a Train, again, well, it was the first novel written by queer anti-Semite Patricia Highsmith.
okay, starting off with a bang.
Everyone, y'all should go listen to our Patreon episode on Adrienne Lyne's Deep Water, where we talk about how she is a queer anti-Semite. Anyway, but some may also call her the mistress of suspense, whereas Hitchcock is the master of suspense. And yeah, he kind of, I mean, discovered, you know, he read this book, he loved it, and he secured the rights for just $7,500. And that hoodwinking you mentioned, he kept his name out of negotiations to keep the purchase price low, because I guess, you know, if you see, oh yeah, Alfred Hitchcock wants this, they're going to be like, cool, $1 million, please.
Absolutely. Jack up that price.
But yeah, so the thing is, though, both Hitchcock and Highsmith were both attracted to dark subject matter, and specifically the fact that irrationality, perverseness, and strangeness, and the desire to commit crime is in everybody, in all normal people. I guess Highsmith has this idea where, you know, when you're walking down the street, you might see a sadist and a murderer, but you'll never know. And so that is something that was very intriguing to both Highsmith and Hitchcock.
Oh my gosh. Think about those thoughts on your way to work this week, folks.
I mean, right? I mean, and that's kind of the kicking off point for this movie.
Truly, yeah. Could be right there on your train.
Yep. But this was the first film that Hitchcock was shooting for Warner Brothers under his new contract. And by now, he'd been making films in America for 10 years, again, starting with 1940's Rebecca. But when starting production on this film, he told everyone on set, this is my first real film. This is the real beginning of my American career.
Oh, okay.
So I know there's a couple different ways to interpret that. It's like, well, what about the last 10 years of movies you've been doing? Like, do they not count? But apparently, and people think that he meant by this, he had found a subject that absolutely delighted him in this novel about two men who exchange murders. Like, he had not been this excited about a premise since coming to America.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I can see that then.
Now, important to note, you know, there are a couple differences between the book and the film, but the big change is that Guy, the Farley Granger character, does go on and commits the murder. He kills Bruno's father, which is the whole point of the novel, you know, a good person being corrupted. I would imagine they changed that due to the censors, because everyone, as we've discussed many times, you cannot have a murderer get away with anything when these censors were in place.
No, you gotta kill them on a carousel.
Now, jumping right into gay shit. So, Hitchcock had done a treatment of the book with Whitfield Cook, who was a family friend, but he wove homoerotic subtext into the story. And there is a historical reason for this. So the Red Scare was gathering steam at this time, which would have been the year 1950. And Cook used the Guy character to make the film a parable quietly defiant of the Cold War hysteria sweeping America. And that hysteria was targeting homosexuals along with communists as enemies of the state. You know, the U.S. Senate was busy investigating the suspicion that quote-unquote moral perverts in the government were also undermining national security, going so far as to commission a study, The Employment of Homosexuals and Other Sex Perverts in the Government, which, love being called a sex pervert.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I think we talked about this a little bit on our episode, I think on The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That would make sense. But specifically, it was argued that Strangers on a Train was crucially shaped by the congressional inquiries, making Guy the stand-in for victims of the homophobic client. So to all appearances, Guy is the all-American stereotype, an athlete, unassuming despite his fame as a tennis player, conservatively dressed. He's a man of indeterminate sexual identity found in circumstances making him vulnerable to being compromised. And, I mean, again, everyone go listen to our episode on Rope, because Hitchcock had drawn gay characters so sharply in that film. So that's why he drafted the left-leaning Cook, expressly because he knew Cook was comfortable with sexually ambiguous characters.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, folks, I was going to argue, if you want additional information about what was going on in this time period, there was a great queer series called Fellow Travelers with Matt Bomer and Jonathan Bailey. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that they dropped the ball on a lot of the historical stuff, but it is about, you know, closeted queer politicians. So it does sort of segue in this topic.
Okay. But would you recommend that show? Because I still haven't started it.
The sex is really hot and they're giving really good performances, but I felt like the writing constantly let the narrative down. And I was actually really fucking frustrated with how they use their person of color characters. It's they're just shoehorned in on their own side plot and they barely interact. It's very annoying.
Oh, that's such a bummer. Well, okay, maybe I'll still give it a watch, but...
Oh, yeah, it's worth watching because it's lush, the costumes are great, the two lead performances are really good, but there's just some drawbacks. It's not a slam dunk.
Gotcha. Well, adapting this novel, because again, we don't have a script yet, we have a treatment.
Right.
Adapting the novel was a very troubled process because at the suggestion of Warner Brothers and in keeping with the practice of working with novelists rather than professional screenwriters, Hitchcock accepted a screenwriting deal from Raymond Chandler. And this guy, he was a great hard-boiled detective story writer and just 6 years earlier had earned an Oscar nomination for his first screenplay, Double Indemnity, which he had co-written. He wasn't the sole screenwriter. But so he was going to adapt Hitchcock and Cook's treatment. Sounds fine. Unfortunately, a Hitchcock treatment could be anything from 65 to 100 pages, and what they are is basically the movie without dialogue.
Oh, okay.
Because as we all know, you know, Hitchcock is a big visualist, right?
Right.
He speaks to the visual language of the screen, and dialogue's kind of like for the screenwriter to do. Chandler did not accept this.
So it was a great marriage, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So he tried to change a bunch of things. He didn't really understand some of the visual ideas that were already there in the treatment. A big one being the moment where Guy is playing tennis and, you know, you see like the heads of everyone in the crowd going left, right, but not Bruno's. He's just sitting there staring right at him.
Right, yes.
Yeah, he didn't get that.
Okay.
He also preferred Highsmith's original story, saying that Hitchcock was too ready to, and I quote, sacrifice dramatic logic, insofar as it exists, for the sake of a camera effect. And he also, like, on top of not really getting the treatment, he didn't really like Hitchcock that much.
Hitch was notoriously difficult to work with, not just with his leading ladies, as we will also talk about in this film, but
yeah,
I mean, he was a perfectionist. He wanted things done his way. And if he's not valuing things like dialogue or narrative consistency, if you are the person who's responsible for that, that's going to be frustrating.
I feel like that's such a thing, too. I mean, look, I'm not a screenwriter. I have no idea what this is like, but if the director of a film is telling you to do it some way, isn't that your job to do it?
Well, often you may not have a director who would be this hands-on, right? I mean, Hitch is kind of unique in that way, or maybe this is more commonplace for the times, but, you know, I'm thinking there's a lot of times where people just write scripts and then there's a director who gets attached to them and maybe tweaks it. Generally, you wouldn't start with a director's treatment.
Well, because I guess normally you also wouldn't have the director like working that closely with the writer, especially not nowadays, right, unless the director is the screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, again, I'm just kind of like, it's Alfred Hitchcock.
I mean, it's also Raymond Chandler. We should note.
Yeah.
He's huge in terms of literary prowess, and I'm sure if he's hired to do this, he's thinking, okay, I just got a fucking Oscar nom a couple years ago, so this is big personalityville.
Yeah, well, so when discussing his meetings with Hitchcock, he says, and I quote, "The meetings were god-awful jabber sessions, which seemed to be an inevitable, although painful part of the picture business."
Ooh, boy.
Supposedly, Chandler got more combative as time went on, even going so far as to point at Hitchcock one day when he was getting out of his car and yelled, "Look at the fat bastard trying to get out of his car."
All right, let's not go down to petty insults here.
Yeah, so that was the end of his involvement in the project after turning in two drafts of the screenplay. Hitchcock did not like him at all, so his idea now, he's like, we're going to start from scratch. We are not going to use any part of this man's screenplay. So it's turned over to a woman named Shinzi Ormond, who was a collaborator of screenwriter and playwright Ben Hecht. Hitchcock actually wanted Hecht, but Hecht was unavailable, so he was like, here, please take my lady friend.
Sure.
Apparently, again, I'm saying apparently a lot because I'm just kind of like, just these things seem so far-fetched to be real, but
just say allegedly then.
Allegedly. he met with Ormond and he holds up Chandler's latest draft and performatively throws it in the trash can in front of her.
Oh, God.
He says, forget this. We're not using any of this man's screenplay. Forget Highsmith's novel. And he tells her the story as best he can remember and says, cool, now that I've told you this, write a screenplay based off of that.
Interesting. Okay. This is a novel exercise.
Yeah, but the problem, Joe, is there wasn't really a lot of time left. They had less than 3 weeks until location shooting was scheduled to start in the East. Ooh. So what Ormond did was she hunkered down with Hitchcock's associate producer, Barbara Keon, and his wife, Alma Revel, who, again, as we all know, is a big contributor on a lot of these screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
Together, the three women, working under Hitchcock's guidance, but he wasn't there, and I'll tell you why in a minute. And late into most nights, they finished enough of the script in time to send the company east, and the rest was completed by early November. But filming started in October.
Okay.
So while the three women were doing the writing, Hitchcock was already off shooting the scenes in Washington and Connecticut without a script. And this isn't the first time he had done that, but it's still kind of like, oh, yeah, we're just writing the script as we go along.
Oh, boy. Never a recipe for goodness.
Not at all. So when he came back and actually started shooting, you know, in California, Ormond was on the set writing. And it took several weeks into the production before they even found the carousel ending. But the main notable additions these three women added were the runaway merry-go-round in the climax,
mm-hmm,
the cigarette lighter, which is a pretty big plot point in the film.
Just a little.
And Miriam's thick eyeglasses, which we will get to in a minute.
Right.
But you'll notice, however, if you look at the credits for the film, the screenplay is credited to both Ormond and Chandler, despite none of Chandler's work ending up in the final product.
Hmm.
Well, Hitchcock preferred the writing credit of Cook from his treatment and Shinzi Ormond, but Warner Brothers wanted the prestige status of Chandler's name and said, nope, his name's got to stay on this.
Cool. Let's give the credit to a man when the women did the work. Got it.
Just par for the course for 1950.
Yes, just 1950.
Now, for those of you who did not listen to our Rope episode, it's important to note that, you know, we have Farley Granger as one of the lead characters in this film, and he is an out and proud-ish bisexual actor.
All right.
But yeah, so he had just worked with Hitchcock 3 years prior on Rope, and he was told that Hitchcock wanted to see him, and he had to go to his house. And I'm just kind of like, what must that be like, right? Like, hey, Alfred Hitchcock wants to see you. Go over to his house really quick.
I guess presumably it means, oh, he probably has a juicy role for me, so I'm going to go immediately.
Which is exactly what happened. So he goes out to his house on Bellagio Drive. He Hitchcock invited him onto the terrace and goes, sit down, have a drink. I want to tell you a story. And he basically did exactly what he did with our mom, where he tells him the story of this movie and goes, hey, we start working on Monday in Washington, D.C. Get ready.
My God, drop everything. You're in the movie.
But I guess, though, because, again, we're still in the studio system here. Everyone's on contract. They have, like, strict schedules. So I'm assuming if Warner Brothers is like, yeah, obviously, like, you can drop whatever the fuck you're doing and go shoot with Hitchcock.
Sure, yeah. At this point in his career, he would probably have that level of clout.
Exactly. Production takes place from October through December of 1950, with filming being completed just before Christmas. This was the beginning of a very long collaboration between Alfred Hitchcock and cinematographer Robert Burks. Burks would kind of stay with him through all of Hitchcock's films, all the way through Family Plot, I think, but he would not shoot Psycho. That's the important one.
Oh, okay.
However, Burks did receive Strangers on a Train's only Academy Award nomination, which was for Best Cinematography in Black and White.
Okay.
The film previewed on March 5th, 1951 at the Huntington Park Theater in California, and it won a prize from the Screen Directors Guild. It premiered in New York on July 3rd of 1951, marking the reopening of the extensively remodeled Strand Theater as the Warner Theater, and it also opened in a dozen cities around the country. Hitchcock, as per usual, made personal appearances at most of them, often accompanied by his daughter, Patty. Some audience feedback at Jack Warner's office condemned the film for its sordid story. But there were just as many others that were like, yeah, this is great. We love it.
Sure. I mean, the queer-coded character gets punished, so shut the fuck up.
Right? Bruno is a total mo in this movie.
100%. Yeah.
And, of course, a mama's boy, which is, again, common with Hitchcock films.
Mm-hmm.
But Warner didn't care about these like negative things, though. All he cared about was the box office take. And of course, the receipts did tell the story. Strangers on a Train was a success, and Hitchcock was pronounced at the top of his form as a master of the dark, melodramatic suspense thriller, which that's a mouthful.
That is indeed. But you know what? I would love to have that attached to my name.
So I will say, Joe, I have the Blu-ray of this, you know, and it comes with what they call the preview version of the film. And it's about 2 minutes longer than the theatrical cut. I actually didn't watch it because there weren't enough differences to like really merit, I think, a rewatch. But this version was shown twice, and then some things were trimmed and replaced. But the big difference, though, was the ending. The ending of the preview version was kind of a bland one, where you just see Ruth Roman talking to Farley Granger on the phone, finding out he's all right, and then, you know, you fade out on her shining face, and we're fine. But we don't have that scene at the end where it's Roman and Granger on the train being approached by someone, which I think is perfect.
It's amusing. Yeah. It's a better way to end it.
Yeah. Supposedly, or allegedly, Hitchcock thought the picture should have ended with Guy at the amusement park after he had been cleared of murdering his wife. He wanted the last line of the film to be Guy describing Bruno as, and I quote, a very clever fellow, then fade out. But Warner Brothers found this ending unacceptable.
Interestingly enough, I think that would have also been acceptable.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it has kind of the darker ending, whereas the one we have, again, as you said, is more amusing.
Well, it's more amusing and it solidifies the heterosexual romance.
Well, and I also think, though, because, I mean, I didn't really bring this up, but, like, again, shockingly, Hitchcock did not like Ruth Roman. He did not think she was glamorous enough, but the studio made him cast her. So, again, she was his punching bag on this film.
Yeah, to the point that Granger, I think, is on record as saying, oh, yeah, he was really mean to her. There's always one person that Hitch is mean to on every production. Yep. And on this one, it was her.
And I really like her character because, again, yep. I like that she catches wise very early on, and because I wasn't expecting that.
Oh, thank goodness. I thought he was going to lie to her throughout the entire film.
Yep. Much less interesting, right?
Oh, God. It's always super boring when you keep people in the dark.
But yeah, so upon its initial release in 1951, the film did receive mixed reviews. You know, some people thought it was fine, some people thought it wasn't. the definition of mixed reviews. In contrast, though, modern reviews have been overwhelmingly positive. On Rotten Tomatoes, we've got a 98% with an average score of 8.8 out of 10. Letterboxd users have given it an 8.2 out of 10. Roger Ebert said this is one of Hitchcock's five best films.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's one of those things where I wonder what changed, you know, over the, what, 60 years since this film's, 70 years since this film's release.
Yeah, I wonder if it's that we just have a better appreciation of what Hitch was doing. Like, imagine living in a time where Hitchcock was just debuting a new film every couple of years.
That's the thing, right? Like, what is the modern equivalent of that? You know, who are our auteurs who are just still churning things out? I mean, arguably, Denis Villeneuve.
Maybe Scorsese, if people like him.
Yeah, Scorsese. Tarantino's got one more in the bank. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, time will tell.
Notice that it's all men that we're talking about.
It sure is all men. Women can't direct films.
Yeah, it's called We Just Actually Need to Give Them the Opportunity and maybe make more than one. What? Who said that?
Yeah. But you know what? That's what happens, Joe. You know, these women, they make one movie that's maybe really good, but it doesn't do well at the box office. So obviously it's the woman's fault if she can't get a job again.
Sure. And then she gets to make television for the rest of her life, which is also fine. But
totally
also,
fine.
I would just like to see a few more female directors maybe have careers with some longevity to them.
Yeah, just a little bit. Joe, I mean, that's all I got. So what happens in this movie?
All right. So as you alluded, there is plenty of queer shit and people have picked up on it. So I'm going to be drawing references from three different pieces. The first is from Danny Savage, which ironically, not the sex columnist guy. That would be Dan Savage.
Okay. I was confused.
So this is Danny Savage from his site, Savage Film. And the article is called Homosexuality in Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train. We also have Noah Gattel, Murder and Queer Commentary Brew in Strangers on a Train from Washington City Paper. Okay. And finally, Mervyn Nicholson, Stranger and Stranger, Hitchcock and Male Envy from Bright Lights Film Journal.
Oh my God, you've got all the resources for us today, Joe.
All the resources, yes. Okay. So, Trace, you're going to be shocked by this. This movie opens with trains and a train station.
Oh, Joe, are there doubles in this movie? Are we constantly reiterating doubles constantly?
Just doubles, you know. Yeah, it's almost like a courtship. These men who could be dark mirrors of each other or something like that. But also, in this opening sequence, Savage is going to point us to train doubles, or rather trains that are taking different directions. So Savage says right from the opening, we've got this point of view shots of a train that's traveling on a straight linear path until it diverts to a non-linear, curved course. And the railway tracks, a literal manifestation of Bruno's infamous line, crisscross, foreshadowed the disruption of Bruno into Guy's life. But the train is no longer traveling on a straight path and suggests that this particular Hitchcock train deviates from the sexual norm.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I love the opening of this where, ironically enough, it's kind of like what I talked about with Marnie, where we're just seeing the back of people, right? So we're seeing the back of Guy, we're seeing the back of Bruno, we're at the ground level, so we're just seeing their shoes, and then they both board this train, and then they just clink feet as they sit down across from each other.
I love the introduction of these characters. Because, we don't see their faces until they finally sit down, but it's also, so we're forced to then pay attention to what they're wearing. One of them's wearing white shoes, the other one's not. And there are different angles too. This was a sort of fun, clever way to do this, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, this is Hitchcock doing his visual storytelling. It's not reliant on dialogue until the two men actually sit down face to face. And then it's a bunch of, pay attention to who knows what, because we are doing character backstory, but also the manipulation and the blackmailing and all that kind of stuff has already begun.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have outgoing Bruno, who is played by Robert Walker. He introduces himself to tennis player Guy Haines, who is Farley Granger, and he clearly has been reading the newspaper. He's clearly been reading Page Six, which is the celebrity column, because he knows all about Guy's relationship with Senator Morton's daughter, Anne, even though we learn that Guy is actually married to someone else.
Oh my god. And that someone else, I wanted to be in this movie a lot more.
Miriam.
Miriam. Is she not the most fascinating character?
I mean, it's interesting in 1951 to see a character who is an unabashed slut.
Oh. I was not expecting that, but yes. Yes. And she is evil. I mean, to the point where I was just kind of like, oh, like, because she's a femme fatale type character, even though this isn't yeah. really a film noir. But, like, mm-hmm. she has two scenes. But one is dialogue heavy. The other one is not.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, man, like, are we really going to kill you so soon?
Yes, because that's also what we do in Hitchcock movies.
Of course we do. Interestingly enough, though, so Robert Walker, I do think kind of runs away with this movie because I find his psychopath just fascinating.
Ooh, yeah. What a fascinating performance.
He never played villains up until this year. So this exact same year, he did a Burt Lancaster Western called Vengeance Valley. And it's kind of, he was like, oh yeah, I kind of want to keep doing this. Unfortunately, he would die the year after this movie. I'm sorry, like 3 months after this movie was released.
Oh no, that's so unfortunate because this feels, I mean, again, I don't really know too much about these people other than, you know, what we know from other Hitchcock films and that kind of stuff. But yeah, his performance is so amazing. I could imagine this offering him some kind of career renaissance.
Yeah, it was, so he was an alcoholic and he, like, his kids went out to go play with their mother or something, and he got so drunk he passed out, and his psychiatrist came in and tried to inject him with something to, like, wake him up, and I guess it had an adverse reaction.
Oh, no.
And he didn't wake up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so on that making of Blu-ray, his son is on there as an interviewer talking about it.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is dark.
It's dark, but I mean, it's like, you know, 70, well, I guess by the time, because the documentary, I think, was done in the early 2000s, because Farley Granger is still alive when they were doing it.
Okay.
But anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Bruno basically strong arms Guy back to his cabin so that they can have lunch. And this, in the privacy of his train car, is where he introduces this concept of swapping murders or crisscrossing murders. So, you know, Guy has this wife who he needs to divorce so that he can be with Ann Morton, the senator's daughter. And Bruno has a father that he fucking hates.
Yeah. So do murder, if you will, Joe.
Indeed, yes.
If everyone listened to our outro last week, the reason I knew about this film and, like, the plot was because of that Netflix teen rom-com. I don't want to call it a rom-com, a teen comedy, mm-hmm. Do Revenge, which is great and you should all watch it.
Yeah, it's quite solid and it definitely lifts the premise of this, which is, you know what, we're going to deal with each other's exes. They don't kill them. They just try to get revenge on them.
Yeah, they do revenge.
They do revenge. Is that a verb? Is that something we're saying? That's a joke from that film. Yeah.
It is. It is.
Okay. So this is what Bruno suggests. And Guy basically is just sitting here open mouth looking at this stranger who says, no, it'll be totally fine because no one can connect us because we don't actually know each other. And Guy's like, I have to get off the train now, so I'll talk to you never.
I feel so bad for Guy in this entire movie, because honestly, I would react the same way. Like, I'm too much of a chicken shit to be like, no, dude, you're a fucking psychopath. Get away mm-hmm. from me, because I don't want to have that kind of confrontation, especially in a fucking public place like a train.
Oof.
But yeah, I would be the one that's like, oh, yeah, good mm-hmm. for you, man. Good plan. And then, you know, get looped into this whole thing.
Always happy to meet a fan. Thanks so much for reaching out. Here I go.
I'm just too nice. I'm too nice.
You're so nice. Yeah. Basically, this is what Guy does. He kind of treats it like they're having a bit of a joke. And then he says, well, unfortunately, I've got to go because Metcalf is my stop. I've got to get off and deal with my ex-wife. So, pleasure meeting you and goodbye.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, he leaves behind a monogrammed lighter that Anne has given him, which Bruno promptly pockets. And then we get Hitchcock's usual cameo as Guy gets off the train and it seems like the two men will go their own separate ways.
His daughter directed his cameo too.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. fun. Okay, so in Metcalf, Guy spars quite strongly with his wife Miriam, who is played by Casey Rogers. She I was trying to figure this out. Is it a record store? And is that why they have soundproof booths where they can go and fight?
That's what I thought, but I'd never seen anything like this before, so I really wasn't sure.
Okay. The only reason I kind of think that's what it is because I recognize it from Empire Records, which you still haven't seen and is really good. But yeah, they have a similar kind of setup in that film.
That makes sense. That makes sense. But lest you think that guy was exaggerating the heinousness of his wife, he is not. She is a piece of work.
She is pretty awful. I think one of the things I like the most is that when you meet her, she seems nice. Like, she's very attractive. She's got these big, thick glasses. But overall, like, before she actually starts talking or interacting with Guy, you think, oh, she seems sweet, like somebody's kid's sister. And then they get into the booth and she's like, I'm pregnant and I've been seeing these pictures of you with the senator's daughter and I don't think I want a divorce anymore because I think I can get some money out of you, star tennis player.
Well, that's the thing. So she's going to get child support from him. And he's like, but it's not my baby. And she's like, well, no one's going to know that. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh.
And he can't afford to make a stink about it because if she did tattle to the papers, he would definitely look guilty.
100%. Yeah. Maybe she's a slut, just like her mother.
She's an amazing character.
But this, because what I like too is that she doesn't, I mean, yes, she is a very attractive woman, but she doesn't look like how you would think this kind of femme fatale character to look because of these glasses.
Yeah, she's not a vamp at all. Like, she almost looks like a plain Jane, but then the minute she opens her mouth, you're just like, oh, she's a piece of work.
But okay, but I think that ties into her character so well, though, because okay, and, like, we make jokes all the time about, you know, glasses and a ponytail. Oh my God, like, put it on a hot woman, she's instantly ugly by Hollywood standards. But
sure.
But with this movie, I'm kind of like, yeah, I kind of get it, though, because I feel like maybe she's been underestimated because she's not the glamour queen that, you know, Ruth Gordon's character in this movie is.
Right.
So that contributed to her evilness?
Well, I mean, the way that I look at it is that she's a bit of a mirror to Bruno. You know, Guy is this all-American, good-looking dude, and he's met Anne, who is a better match for him, but he keeps attracting these seemingly innocuous, random people into his life. So Bruno is a psychopath, and to a certain extent, Miriam is too, but they wear their disguise under this facade of just normalness.
100%. But it's subversive, and like, you don't expect it, which I think makes it even more interesting, because if she was just this tall, gorgeous, I don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, it would still be effective, but it wouldn't be as surprising to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, needless to say, her threat to blackmail him does not go well. Guy has a bit of a temper, so they end up getting into a physical altercation that has to be broken up by the store manager, as well as witnessed by everyone in this store. So, needless to say, when she turns up dead in a couple of scenes, it's not a big surprise that Guy gets fingered for the murder.
I will say, again, because my only knowledge of this story was what I had seen in Do Revenge, I really, really didn't know that he wasn't going along with this whole time. I really thought the premise of this film was two men do agree to do each other's murders.
Right.
And again, like, you know, as Chandler is saying, I think that that aspect of the book is a more interesting path, and I do agree. I actually would like to see what that version of the movie is, because I just like watching two leads that are morally compromised. But
sure. Yeah, we're not going to get it in 51, but there's no reason why we couldn't remake this. Obviously, you would call it something different and try to get as far away from Hitchcock's masterpiece as you could, but the premise is still good.
Well, I didn't realize that Danny DeVito movie, Throw Mama from the Train, is also heavily inspired by this movie.
Oh, wow. You just kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, because I think it's about, he's like, kill my mother, please. I hate her.
He absolutely is. And that mom is a real piece of work, too.
Anne Ramsey.
Oh, boy. She's a nightmare. I hated her so much as a kid. Because she's from the Goonies, too.
Right, which I still have never finished.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
I didn't like it, so I turned it off. Sorry.
Okay. Everyone be kind to Trace. Do not come after him for these things, please.
No. To be fair, it was a high school party, but it was like a theater party, so we were all like watching the movie, and I just walked out of the room because I watched like half of it, and I was like, nope, not, I don't like this.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day.
Maybe one day.
Okay, so after this altercation with Miriam, Guy goes outside. He goes back to the train station so that he can call Anne, who, as we said, is played by Ruth Roman. And I enjoy the way that we're using the diegetic sound from the train to mask partially what he's saying. But what do you make of the scene, Trace? Because he's very clearly yelling into the phone, oh, I could just kill her. I hate her so much. And there isn't really anybody around. So I wasn't sure if this is just meant to outline, oh, he would be willing to make these threats against his ex-wife. Or are we meant to think, oh, he's just yelling these threats in the open.
I think it's the latter. I don't think this character has the capability of murder, at least not Hitchcock's version of this character.
Right. Okay.
But it really does suck that he says, I could strangle her, and that's exactly how Miriam ends up dying.
Yeah. Okay, so we switch to Bruno's perspective. He goes home, and we learn he's very well off. Like, they're living in a McMansion. His mom, who doesn't have a first name, she's only referred to as Miss Antony. She's played, as you said, by Marion Lorne. She is very protective of her little boy. So she's worried about his complexion. Yeah, she's concerned about his former plans to blow up the White House. So she knows that something is wrong with him, but she still coddles him.
Well, and so this is from some of the film historians on this documentary, but they continue, like, Hitchcock loved to subvert the idea of mom and apple pie. Hitchcock never plays a middle-aged woman as anything but a monster.
God.
And Marion Lauren's mother is perhaps the most monstrous of them all because she is just as crazy as Bruno is. All these women representing something, a sort of demented lust for order. And they always have a Bruno around who is disturbing the order. The reason why mothers are so responsible for this very often is because they won't let go. Could anything have moved Mrs. Antony away from her son? Could you tell her anything that would make a difference?
No.
No, and we'll find that out later when Anne goes to see her.
We literally get a scene where Anne says, hey, I think your son committed a murder. And she says, you have no proof.
It's a practical joke.
God, ma'am. Yeah, I also have a quote for this scene. So Nicholson says, closeness to mother is a standard marker in the movies of the 50s for, in quotations, something wrong. So association with mother does not necessarily denote homosexuality, but it does denote defectiveness. And Hitchcock had already used this motif in Notorious in 1946, where the bad guy who is a Nazi is conspicuously linked with a mother who appears to control him.
But see, though, like, I didn't really get that she was controlling in any of this. I just thought she was loopy.
No, so they're talking about Notorious, where that mother is definitely in charge. Okay. But in this case, you know, it's that not domineering, but the mother who will look out for her son at all costs. It's a familiar archetype that Hitchcock is familiar with. He's played with it before.
Right. And again, this is a character that I would have gladly taken more of.
Oh, yeah. She's interesting. We don't really get a ton of time with any of the parents in this film, but I would argue that it's really, what do you think, about a four-person film? Like, it's Bruno and Guy and Anne, and then to a slightly lesser degree, Babs.
Yeah. But again, you have this, like, colorful cast. I mean, not literally colorful, but you have a colorful cast of supporting characters.
Oh, yeah. No, this movie is white.
It's white, yeah. This is 1951.
Not an excuse, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so the other thing we should note is that people have picked up on the very flamboyant robe that Bruno was wearing in these scenes. So some people look at that as a visual demarcation that, yeah, he's a big old homo.
And because honestly, the way that Robert Walker plays him, though, is flamboyant.
It's definitely, I mean, to use a contemporary term, he's definitely extra. So this person is outgoing. He's not afraid to be charming, but sly. But yeah, there's a sexual suggestiveness to his candor, I found.
I mean, there's a line at some point in this film where he just tells Guy, I like you. And it can easily be read as sexual.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. Like, why do you like him so much? It's not just because he's a famous tennis player.
Well, actually, question for you then. Do you think he purposefully set up this train meeting, or do you think it was a happenstance?
No, my God. Of course it was orchestrated.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
I think just because he evidently knows so much about his life that I would assume he would have looked for an opportunity to engage with him because he's saying, oh, this person is the perfect cover, but also from a queer reading, I've fallen in love with you from what I know about you.
Okay.
Okay, so yes, we see Bruno looking at his mom's hobby, which is painting, and she basically she looks like she's painting Dorian Gray style. Oh, so
I wrote she painted Bruno a picture. Well, he thinks it's the father, but she said right. It was St. Francis. But I wrote in my notes, this is Dorian Gray.
Yeah. Like late stage Dorian Gray after yeah. He's committed all the atrocities.
I was disappointed we didn't get a Technicolor shot of it.
Ah, that would have been great.
Right? But it's this deformed mess.
Yes, it is very expressionistic.
Okay, actually, too, if I read Bruno as queer, you could also make the argument that he hates his father because his father berates him and bullies him for being queer.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah. So this is when we're introduced to his father, who is played by Jonathan Hale. Basically, Bruno gets a call from Guy, so he steps out, but we can hear his father talking about him in the background to his mom. He's obviously very concerned about his son, and he even says that he can put his son in restraints if need be. And I read this personally as, oh, okay, he knows something is wrong, but you could take it as, oh, he's a psychopath, so we're going to lock him up. Or there's something a little queer about him, and, you know, that's still a medical disorder, so we could get him put in the loony bin.
Oh, right. Do you know when it stopped being a medical disorder?
We've definitely touched on this before. I think it was like 70.
So homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder in the DSM, beginning with its first edition the year after this came out in 1952.
Okay.
In 1974, the DSM was updated and homosexuality was replaced with a new diagnostic code for individuals distressed by their homosexuality.
You know what? That's more appropriate.
Sure. Distress over one's sexual orientation remained in the manual under different names until the DSM-5 in 2013.
I think that's just called internalized homophobia now.
I think so. But yeah. So again, the timing here, right? Which honestly, I wonder if that's tied to the Red Scare.
I would not be surprised at all.
Yeah. Like people like snitching on their neighbors, like going to the psychiatrist, like, hey, can you add this to your book, please? Thanks.
We're seeing a wave of it in closeted politicians around the D.C. area. Mitch McConnell, is that you?
We keep finding these Republican politicians in bathroom stalls with little boys.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so Bruno decides he's going to be proactive. He's going to look up Miriam's address. So that night, he follows her and several men, because as we said, she's got an active social life after dark.
That's the thing. Like, she is whoring herself around this entire carnival.
I love it!
When she sees Bruno, she even considers him. And I'm kind of like, you know what? Work
Good
it, girl.
You, girl.
Like, you do your thing.
100%.
Feminism.
She's putting it out there and the guys are picking it up and she's having a good old time. And
it's fun.
Yeah. But I agree with you. I love this idea that Bruno is following her and he just keeps showing up at all these different stops on the carnival and she is intrigued. And that's fascinating.
I do love the kind of fake out scare we get here, too, because they go into the tunnel of love together and we cut to the exit and we hear a scream thinking, yes. Oh my God, he killed her in the tunnel of love.
Yep.
And they come out and they're fine.
Yeah, they've just been roughhousing. He's still behind her in a different boat and everything. Yep. Important to note, before they get into the boats for the tunnel of love, we do see Bruno hit the high striker game and he's so strong that he breaks it.
And that's what turns her on. She gets real wet watching this.
I mean, sure, but that's also how he so easily strangles her in a couple minutes.
Yeah, she really didn't have a chance.
No. So we see her kind of get sequestered off from the men that she's with, and Bruno is there. And I love this. He is careful because he asks her name to make sure he's got the right floozy. And then when he knows that it's her, that's when he strangles her. But of course, we see it in the reflection from her fallen glasses on the ground.
Okay, so this is one of those moments where I was watching this and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And then
yes.
I'm doing research and I'm like, of course, yes, this is the shot in this movie that is singled out, studied by film classes. And I was like, yes, I got it.
Yeah, I mean, there's this and then there's the climax that are just... Right. They're honestly astonishing visual sequences in this movie. They're so memorable. They're so just carefully and purposefully executed, and they just do a bang-up job of accomplishing what they're trying to do. Like, this is where you see Hitchcock at his top form.
Well, so the way this shot was done, so it was a more complex, like, idea than the actual execution, thankfully. Oh, okay. But Hitchcock got the exterior shots in Canoga Park using both actors. So, you know, we've got Robert Walker as Bruno and Casey Rogers as Miriam.
Mm-hmm.
And later, he had Rogers alone report to a soundstage where there was a large concave reflector set on the floor. And the camera was on one side of the reflector, whereas Rogers was on the other. And Hitchcock directed Rogers to turn her back to the reflector and I quote, float backwards all the way to the floor like you were doing the limbo.
Oh.
The first six takes went badly. Rogers thudded to the floor with several feet yet to go. But on the seventh take, she floated smoothly all the way. Hitchcock's even strained response, cut, next shot.
So supportive.
I mean, just this whole shot. A part of me was like, is this a way around the censors to hide the actual murder happening on screen? But I mean, I guess we saw people get strangled all the time at this time period, right?
Yeah, I think this is just more artful. This is Hitchcock being playful and trying to experiment with the form.
Yeah, but I will say I was really bummed. I was like, oh man, we're losing her. Like, oh, why can't we kill the dad first? But obviously we can't do that.
Yeah, spoiler alert. The dad will survive. We will never see him again.
Yeah, he's out of this movie. But then it's just a movie about obsession, right? Like, I just view this as he is obsessed with Guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I even have it in my notes. This is basically a stalker movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Bruno collects both the lighter, which is what he used to illuminate his presence to Miriam, as well as her glasses, which, you know, one could argue, man, why are you collecting objects from the murder site? But he does it to prove to Guy later, yes, I actually killed her because you recognize these glasses.
I love him. He's like, but if you don't do what I want, I'm going to go put it back there. I'm like, oh, that's so much travel. Ugh.
But also, you putting something there doesn't prove anything.
Well, but unfortunately, Guy has already set himself up to be the obvious. I mean, they call it out really early. Like, obviously, they're going to go to you first. Mm-hmm. But everything you've done this day really points you as the killer.
Yes. Yeah. So there is one other thing that will ultimately save Guy in addition to the lighter, and that is the boatman, who is played by Murray Alper. So this is the person who helps people get into the Tunnel of Love boats. And when Miriam's male colleagues discover her body, they initially think that she's sleeping or that she's fainted, and then they realize, oh, she's fucking dead. Yep. So we get this big hubbub around the boating area, and of course there's only one person who isn't concerned and is acting very suspiciously, and that would be Bruno, who's making his way through the crowd. So the boatman does take note of his unusual behavior, and this will bite Bruno in the ass later
at the 11th hour.
But I love that we go from this scene to then Bruno helping a blind man cross the street.
Oh my god. That's like morbid humor that I really appreciate.
Well, this movie has a bunch of little funny moments like this that just kept delighting me, because it felt like they didn't need to be in there, but Hitchcock is having fun with this, so he wants to include this. You know, it's not as though this guy is a mustache twirling villain. He will do what needs to be done to accomplish his goals, but he isn't so much of a monster that he won't just help random people.
I wonder if Hitchcock was bummed by the mixed reception the film got. I mean, again, because as you're saying, like, he's having so much fun with this movie because he hasn't been excited about a movie like this in forever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the movie does well, so I'm sure that's his, you know, oh, well, fuck you if you didn't like it, because the people spoke. Okay, so Bruno checks the time, and we use this to transition back to Guy's part of the story, as he is checking his watch on the train home, and he is being entertained by drunken Professor Collins, who is played by John Brown, and this is a Delaware Tech professor who... he's coming back from celebrating, but this will prove to be Guy's alibi, at least initially, when we discover, ooh, Miriam has been murdered. And of course, as the ex-husband, you're suspect number one.
Man, I'm telling you, this guy was not acting drunk enough to have a full blackout for me.
No, like, he's definitely jolly. He's clearly been imbibing and having a good time, but he doesn't recognize guy at all.
Yeah.
And that's, like,
that was a little, like, I'm suspending my disbelief here, but I was kind of like, come on, dude. Like, as someone who has blacked out more than a recently. Couple of times in his yeah. life.
Yesterday?
I know how you act when in there. I mean, I've been told how I act in those moments.
There we go. You don't remember. You were blackout drunk.
Yeah, I don't remember. Oh, my God. I shudder to think of there's like a video out there of me in a blackout state. Oh, God, that'd be horrible.
I mean, there probably is, but hopefully not.
I will say, though, most of my blackouts are unintentional because it's like, oh, I'm drinking after not having eaten all day, you know?
Yeah, that's dangerous. Don't do that.
I don't black out often anymore because I'm obviously older.
Obviously, that must be the thing.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so we get this fantastic Dutch angle as Guy tries to go up his stairs to get into his apartment. And we know, because of the Dutch angle, that something is very wrong. And there's Bruno waiting across the street in the fucking shadows to say, hey, Guy, I killed your ex-wife, and here are her glasses.
I love how he just expects him to be like, all right, cool, where's your dad? I'm going to go kill him right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, cool, we got to talk about how you're going to off my dad. Also, don't try to get out of this, because you're definitely an accomplice, you're an accessory. Like, I've got this lighter, I'm in control of your fate. And I'm trying to imagine being in Guy's position, right? You know, you've met this dude once. He was psychotic, you had a laugh, and then you got off the train, and now days later, he shows up and says, cool, killed that girl for you.
Yeah, 100%. Well, oof. I find situations like this that characters find themselves in just fascinating, because again, like, you know, you want to be like, well, just go tell the cops, but it's also like, Bruno has a point, like, he might still fall for this as the accomplice, so it's like, yeah, you want to do the right thing, but unfortunately, the right thing, even though you are not guilty, might still land you in jail.
Yeah, and honestly, for the rest of the film, at every stage, there's a point where you think, Guy, tell the truth or do the right thing, but he keeps ending up in these situations that are just, it's not going to work, so he has to keep going and digging himself in deeper.
But I like, at least, that it's not a case where it's like he keeps making the quote-unquote wrong decision, because that's less interesting to watch.
It's not fun to watch at all, no.
Like, because I feel like in these movies, you know, the audience is constantly asking themselves, you know, what would you do in this situation? And I feel like, for the most part, Guy does what we would do.
Yeah, especially with the public displays.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen Farley Granger. And, you know, maybe he has a movie where he is kind of like the bad guy, because he plays this same type of character in Rope. And I would love to see him play the Bruno role or the John Dahl role in Rope, you know?
Right. I know what you're saying. I would say this is slightly different from Rope because he is so weak and effeminate. And the film definitely presents that as a character deficiency. Mm-hmm. That's not me passing judgment on him as an actor or the role. But this role, he's a bit more the straight man. You can see that. He's kind of a classic Hitchcock protagonist where he's just a regular dude who's in over his head. But I like him. I found him compelling. I definitely appreciate what you're saying. It'd be fun to see him get to go unhinged or just wild.
I guess, I just think, you know, if you're going from one Hitchcock to the other within a 3-year time span, like, but I get it. That's kind of how we cast people based on their looks, right?
Yeah. I'm just imagining Hitchcock going, I wonder if my favorite gay is available. Okay, so before we leave this scene, I do want to bring Nicholson back in because he does have a notion of how Bruno approaches this situation. So Nicholson says he does not murder Miriam merely because of the fortuitous and expedient contract, but out of genuine, read, twisted concern for Guy. Yes, he seems to love Guy. But this love is really not so much love as an overwhelming admiration. Guy is everything Bruno is not and wishes he could be. Guy is good-looking, successful, poised, independent, industrious. He has social finesse and he knows how to get along with people and be liked by people. Guy is an all-around good guy, clearly. And he's handsome, athletic, he's a professional athlete. He has a goal and direction in life. He's the very exemplar of the all-American boy, one of the guys. He is normal. And that is everything that Bruno is not.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Bruno sticks out like a sore thumb in a good way in this movie.
Oh boy, every time Bruno shows up in a public place, I just start to grind my teeth because I think, what is this guy going to do?
But I also think too, it's again, maybe this is me not being super well versed in films of this time period, but where I'm just like, I'm surprised they did this in this movie.
Oh yeah, there's a couple of points where I thought, did not expect the movie to go this way.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so Guy ends up saying, okay, I've got to go because the phone is fucking ringing off the hook. A policeman just showed up at my door, so clearly they have discovered the body. But before he leaves, there is this moment where it looks like Bruno and Guy are going to kiss in
100%.
The dark. 100%.
I didn't actually think it was going to happen, but...
No, but from a contemporary perspective, you're watching, and the closeness of these two actors' faces, you think, oh, if this is a romance, they're just going to start making out. They do not. That's fine. So, yes, Guy ends up leaving Bruno behind. He goes to Anne's. This is where he receives the tragic news that his ex-wife has died. He has to fake it because, of course, he already knows that she's dead. Performances. B minus, I'm going to say. His reaction was not convincing to me.
Well, I at least appreciate that no one in this room thinks he's the killer. I mean, and as we learn, we'll kind of suspect it because he did tell her the previous day I could just strangle her.
Yeah.
But I like that the senator father is actually, like, on his side from the get-go.
Yeah, he seems to think highly of Guy. He likes them as a match, and there's a couple of points where I wish the film had leaned a little bit more into Guy's political aspirations. We'll learn that, for him, tennis is just a transitory thing, so he is interested in pursuing a career in politics, and it made me... read the interactions between both Guy and Anne, but also Senator Morton a little bit differently, because I thought, did he just ditch his plain Jane wife so that he could get with someone that's going to help his eventual political career?
I mean, I would think that if Miriam wasn't a huge cunt, but she is, or she was.
She did.
No, I'm actually, I understand what you're saying. I guess because for me, it's like, the go-to in these types of films is, hey, be on your best behavior. You cannot ruin my dad's political campaign for whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I just don't want to see that in here.
Okay, that's fair. I don't know if that would have been something we'd be looking at in a film from 51.
No, but now, I mean, again, like, but how many films since then have we seen that do that?
Yeah, it's true.
But yeah, I guess I wouldn't fault it if they did that here, because it would be more of an originator of the trope.
Yeah, potentially. So we've not said, Senator Morton is played by Leo G. Carroll. I think he's also worked with Hitchcock before. And then, of course, we also have her younger sister, Babs, who is played by Pat Hitchcock, also with glasses, a slight lisp, and honestly, this character is a straight shooter. She speaks her mind. She's saying the thing that's on everyone's minds, and she's very astute. And it's a lot of fun.
So her first line where I was like, okay, I like you, character, is, you know, Guy is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry to do this to you. And she just goes, well, Daddy doesn't mind a little scandal. He's a senator.
It's so refreshing, especially because so many of the other characters are straight-laced. Like, Anne is very much oh, my darling, I'm so concerned for you. And Senator Morton is like, okay, son, we're going to get you out of this. And then Babs is over there saying, oh, yeah, they're going to find you guilty. You're going to have to come up with something better than that.
That's the thing. She is the smartest person in this room.
She reads it immediately. She understands exactly what's going to happen. And lo and behold, it fucking does.
Yeah, everything she says happens.
So, yes, she believes that Guy will be named suspect number one, and he says, oh, you know what? It's okay, because I've got this Professor Collins from the train who can act as my alibi. So, he goes in to speak to Police Captain Turley, who is played by Howard St. John. Also on the scene is Lieutenant Campbell, who is played by Edward Hearn, and he's like, I got this. I see the professor is already here, and, oh, fuck. He is too drunk from having celebrated, and he does not remember me at all.
Yeah, I'm celebrating. Okay, so you were thrown.
Celebrated.
Yeah, this is a plot contrivance for me, but whatever.
Sure, it does introduce a new character who will provide some speed bumps for the rest of the movie. That would be Detective Hennessy, who is played by Robert Giss, and he has been assigned to follow Guy everywhere he goes until the case is settled.
Is there another guy, though? Because there's two guys, aren't there?
There is. That would be Detective Hammond. He becomes important a little bit later down the road. Hennessy is the main guy. He's the day guy.
I think I was just a little surprised because Hennessy and Guy have several conversations with each other. And I was like, oh, I guess we're not making this a secret. It's just like, yeah, we have a police escort on you, dude.
Yeah, you know, it's like the two guys who are assigned to protect Sydney and Scream 2.
Oh, yeah, except they're not protecting him. They're like, we're going to watch and see if you murder anyone.
Yes, we're going to protect other people from being murdered by you and also making sure that you don't try to make a run for it.
100%.
Okay, so Guy initially thinks maybe I should cancel my games coming up or maybe I should just lay low in the house. And this is where the political machinations come in. No, he's got to keep up appearances. He can't change anything because otherwise it looks suspicious. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is when Bruno calls and Guy just goes, nope, hangs up.
Hey, so again, Hitchcock being the master of suspense, there's a lot of suspense in this movie, and we get so much mileage of Bruno just being there, staring at Guy
all the time.
Like, there's this, I think we're about to hit to a part where, you know, a guy is walking around Washington, D.C., and he looks at the steps of, I don't know, the Lincoln Memorial or something.
Yes.
And he's Bruno's just standing there staring at him. And I'm like, that is fantastic.
And it's a haunting image. I mean, obviously, Hitchcock infamously uses historical landmarks in his films, but there's something really striking about this extreme long shot of just Bruno in shadow. We know it's him, but he's just standing there. He's not moving. He's not calling out to Guy. He's not drawing attention to himself. But just his sheer presence is so unnerving.
Yeah, it's a thing where I really want to know more about this character. I feel like we know plenty, but like I want to get in this character's head.
Yeah.
And maybe the answer is just he's a psychopath. Like, that is what he is. But again, I'm like, he's so fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to bring in Gittell at this point. So he says, technically, the implicit threat in Bruno's presence is to implicate Guy in the murder of Miriam. But in the world in which Strangers was created, simply being associated with a man who was coded as gay would be enough to make a young aspiring politician quake in his tennis shoes.
Oh, yeah.
So there's like a double threat, right? The straightforward reading of the film, it's like, oh, you can't be associated with this guy because he's the one who murdered your wife, or he's a lunatic, he's unhinged. But also, you can't be seen as, you know, having any kind of relationship with a queer man, particularly in Hollywood at this time of the Lavender Scare.
What's the lesser of two evils? Getting convicted of murder or getting convicted of being gay?
The murder might get you sent away for longer, but...
Well, because I think about this, though. I mean, like, these are things I actually think about, like, if I ever had to go to prison. Because if you were convicted of being gay, your career, as you know it, would be over.
Done.
So, in my mind, I'm like, but honestly, I might just take the murder conviction, because then at least you're in prison getting food for the rest of your life.
I mean, but then you're in prison with the other prisoners.
I mean, yeah, but here's the thing, though. A life where you can't make a living because you're gay is its own form of prison.
Yeah. I mean, thinking back to Fellow Travelers, there's a moment where a supporting character is on the verge of being outed. And I mean, one character gets sent to an asylum where they get shock treatment, which is really fucking upsetting. Mm-hmm. But there's another character where she just quits politics, I'm using air quotes, and goes home to live with her parents.
Oh.
So it's like, you can't make it as a politician, but you could definitely go to a small town and just kind of continue to live your life.
Well, nevertheless, with Guy specifically, his life would be over because he is a high-profile person.
100%, yeah. Because if he's not playing tennis, he's trying to go for politics, and those are both in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so... we see Bruno up there, we hop in a cab, we drive away, so threat nullified. The only problem is that we wake up the next morning, and Bruno has sent Guy a note making plans. You gotta do this. And Guy's like, I'm just gonna burn this.
He's like, hey, my dad's going away soon. Are you gonna get that murder really quick? Come on, let's go.
Can you imagine trying to goad someone into committing a murder and saying, I'll just drop them a note?
And that's why I do think it would be. Well, actually, either version, whether it's, okay, guy is in this from the beginning, he's going for it, or if he murders the father just because he has no other way out of it. Like, again, those are two more interesting movies for me.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, this movie, as we have it, is fine. It's just one of those things where I'm like, oh, but knowing what the book does and knowing what we could have had, I'm kind of like, oh, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. It is interesting, too, because apparently in the book, one of the other big differences is that the politics angle is not the same. So the Mortons are like a well-off family, but they're not distinguished. They're not politicians. The book is actually set in Texas, apparently. The other interesting thing is that in the book, Guy's an architect and he's not a tennis player.
Oh, right. Okay.
Just a very different profession. Like, you could be an architect, but not in the public eye. So they have changed it to make Guy's position quite a bit more high profile, which I think is to increase the tension.
I actually saw that Highsmith was, like, disappointed that they changed him to a tennis star. And I was kind of like, eh. I mean, again, I haven't read the book, so I don't know, like, how important of a part his other job, like, played in the story. But still.
Yeah, I mean, we will soon learn that his role as a tennis player plays a huge role in this movie.
I mean, I was really shocked that we get a full tennis set piece in this thing.
It's not something I expected to see, no. Okay, so the note didn't work. We just burned it up, which means that Bruno has to escalate his stalking behavior. As we learned 2 weeks ago in Greta, sometimes it's not just enough to ignore them because they will turn up.
They sure will.
So Bruno confronts him out in the open when he and Anne are at, I think it's a museum, but, you know, Guy obviously just writes this off. Oh, this is just a fan. I don't actually know this person. The problem is that Bruno, as an ostentatious queer person, is wearing a literal tie pin with his own name on it. And Anne clocks this, and then she will notice it again when he turns up at the tennis match later.
Anne is no dummy. Like, right away, she's like, something is amiss here.
Mm-hmm. Now, in between that, we do get another letter. This time, it's a map and a key to Bruno's house. So, here's how to get to my dad, and I'm also giving you the entrance.
This is clever as hell. I love this.
My God. It's so ballsy, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's again, the thing where I'm like, okay, is he delusional and he does actually believe that he and Guy agreed to do this? Or does he know that he's fucking with him and he's just doing this to be like, yeah, this is my plan. I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I feel like you could make a case for both. I lean a little bit more towards the former. You know, in Bruno's mind, he has done his part of the deal, and now it's time for Guy to do his. So
yeah,
maybe he just needs a little bit of prodding and poking to get it done.
Because again, if you rewatch their initial meeting, he's like, oh yeah, you like my idea? And again, Guy is just kind of like, yeah, it's a great idea. And like, you could read that as Bruno saying, okay, cool, you're agreeing to this then.
Yeah. I'm going to go off and do my part because I'm keen. I'm a go-getter. I'm a straight-A student. Okay, so Bruno escalates again. This time he is waiting when Guy gets off of the court from a tennis match, and he's pretending to be a friend of this powerful family, the Darvilles, and he's wearing the fucking same tie clip. So Anne is like, I definitely know that guy. That's very weird.
This is when we get, though, that great shot of the heads going left and right and left and right, except for Bruno's, as he's like right in the middle of. I thought this was fantastic.
It's great. Yeah. You know, you could argue, as I'm sure Chandler did, do we need this? Like, what's the point of it? But again, it's such a striking visual image. All of Bruno's energy is concentrated on the object of his affection / interest.
Well, it also is just visually interesting as you see all these heads, except for the one turning left and right and left and right. Because also, I feel like that particular reaction into a tennis match, I mean, it's almost always played for comedy.
Right, yeah.
So I love that we're mixing in something that's genuinely threatening into this.
Well, so how often is our attention guided by lack of action, right? Most of the time it's, oh, we're looking for something that moves and that's what captures our attention. Whereas here it's the sheer fact that Bruno isn't doing anything that draws our attention to him.
Yes. Again, loved this.
Yes. So Bruno is really cranking up this tension. Like, he's infiltrated Guy's space, and now Guy has to pretend, oh, sure, I'll sit down, I'll talk to you, and the Darvilles, and so on. And then we get this fantastic moment where Bruno is introduced to Babs, who sort of bears a striking resemblance to Miriam because of the glasses. And Bruno has this reaction where he sees Miriam's head on Babs's body.
Yeah, so I saw this described also as a PTSD flashback, which
It's a guilty conscience. I wouldn't say anything more.
That's the thing, though. I was like, okay, so does he feel bad about murdering Miriam? Is he traumatized from murdering Miriam? Because every time he sees Babs, he freaks out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does remind me of the conversation that we had in Psycho around Norman Bates and his mom, right? Where he feels bad, but also it's not something that he's prepared to go and confess or do anything about. But his body has a reaction, like his conscience will physically manifest something so that, you know, in this case, when Bruno sees Babs, he's actually seeing Miriam. He's not going to do anything about it. He's not going to tell the police, oh, I feel bad about this. But it's just like, oh, it's in the back of his mind. It's something he can't control.
But again, I guess in my mind, I'm just like, well, a psychopath would be able to control that thing because you have to, like, pretend to be in society and be quote unquote normal. So I guess I'm surprised that this is a genuine weakness in this character.
I would say a sociopath might be better able to control it.
Mm, yeah, that's true.
Okay, so next up is Bruno sends Guy a gun.
Wrapped in paper. I love that, too.
It's like how you would buy fish at the market or something. Just to here's something that you're going to need. You've already got the map and the key, so I guess the gun will be the next thing you need.
It's so conspicuous because it's literally like a gun-shaped package.
Yeah, and let's not forget the guy is quite literally being trailed by two different detectives at all times.
Yes. So
he hides this in a drawer and then leaves it be because we have a party at Senator Morton's house, which Bruno promptly crashes. And this, to me, is where the cringe, uncomfortable tension reaches an apex, because Bruno is so socially awkward. So he's trying to pitch Senator Morton on taking a meeting later.
On his idea for harnessing a life force. I was like, what? Are we in science fiction land now?
He's so completely deluded. It's like he doesn't have a grasp in reality at all. He confronts a judge who has recently sentenced a killer to, like, lethal injection. So he's basically saying, like, oh, how can you do this? And the judge is looking at him like, well, that's my job. If you kill someone, you have to die. You have to go to prison.
Right.
And then this reaches a climax when he talks about committing the perfect murder with two society women, Mrs. Cunningham, who's played by Norma Varden, as well as Mrs. Anderson, who is played by Laura Treadwell. And when we do another confusion of Babs and Miriam, well, he's demonstrating strangulation on Miss Anderson. He nearly chokes her out, and then he faints.
Big fan of this scene, because again, I was like, where is this gonna go? And this Norma Varden is just giving a performance, and she's so giddy at the idea, like, oh, how would I commit the perfect murder?
Because to them, it's a parlor game. It's fun conversation that they wouldn't normally have. And he just keeps taking it further, like, oh no, you dumb bitch, that's not the way to do it, because how would you get home if you burn the car?
These conversations are fascinating to me, and again, that they were able to get this in this movie in 1951 is shocking to me.
It's dark. And even just when he starts to strangle her, you think, oh, this is going to cause a fucking commotion, or this is a dream sequence, this can't possibly be real. And it is. You know, we get Bruno out of there as soon as possible, because of course Senator Morton's saying, we can't have this leaking to the press, it will cause a scandal, the next thing you know they'll think we're having orgies in here. Which also, we say the word orgies in this 1951 film.
I do wonder how much they got away with just because it was Hitchcock.
I don't know. Or the other things were more salacious to them, so they're willing to let these kinds of things go.
Yeah, that thing where you put in a bunch of really bad stuff, so they take it out, but they leave the stuff that is still bad that they would normally take away, but not as bad.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so Guy is charged with taking care of Bruno upstairs when he recovers, and he punches him in the face. Punches Bruno.
But this is when we get the line from him where Bruno just goes, "But Guy, I like you."
Yeah, I'm your friend. I like you. I do anything for you.
Mm-hmm. They are lovers. What happened?
One of them is, So Guy punches Bruno in the face. And then he immediately fixes his bow tie. So even though I think the very obvious queer reading for this movie is, oh, Bruno is in love with Guy, and Guy is just this unwilling victim.
Right.
Guy starts to display this kind of, you know, oh, he's not that bad, or I still care for him, or I don't want bad things for him. And this really comes out here as well as in the death scene at the end of the film. But I'm going to bring in Savage for this. So he says, Guy is both repelled and attracted to Bruno while figuratively affirming and denying his homosexuality. At the party, Guy punches Bruno but then shows him tenderness by buttoning his shirt and escorting him out of the house.
Tenderness. That's a very gay word.
Well, there's something to be said for a man doing up another man's buttons and fixing a bow tie. Like, this is the kind of activities that we would usually see a wife or a girlfriend assisting a husband or a partner with, right?
Right. Well, it just feels domesticated.
It does. And it's intimate.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So downstairs, Babs tearfully admits to Anne that Bruno was obviously fantasizing about strangling her. The way that this is written, it almost has a musical quality to it, the way that she says it. You know, he was strangling her, but he was murdering me.
Yes. Again, we get a really good, like, single tear shot from Babs, too, which I love.
Mm-hmm. And Anne is obviously trying to comfort her sister, but when she sees the glasses, she immediately makes the connection to Miriam. Okay. And I love this.
Yes, this is when Anne starts putting it together. She becomes an actual character in this movie, which I love. But I wrote this down, too. I was like, oh, she notices her glasses are just like Miriam's. But when she goes to confront Guy, she says, did Miriam have glasses? So she's doing even extra work because she didn't even really know what Miriam looked like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like she's piecing it together on the fly, but she is so astute. She's picking up on these kind of clues.
Yeah.
And then she immediately is confronting Guy. And I love the fact that he doesn't say, oh, no, 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 she's talking about, blah, blah, blah. Like, we're not denying it. He basically comes clean right on the street to her. So refreshing.
Oh, 100. As you said earlier, like when you have to keep something from a loved one, a friend or whatever the fuck, it's so boring. It's such a boring way to pad out your runtime and just keep. It's also a cheap way of doing suspense, whereas this immediately subverts my expectations. I'm like, okay, cool. He now has an ally, which technically makes things less suspenseful when you give your lead character who's in a bind an out. But this isn't an out for them. Like, he has an ally, but they're still fucked.
Absolutely. And the reality is that if you're confiding in somebody, then that probably means, in my mind, for a lot of films, you're putting them in danger because they're either going to be helping you and putting themselves into situations where there could be violence or murder, or they could be targeted because it's like, oh, okay, well, now that I know that they know, they're expendable. I got to take them off the board.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's the other thing, too. If you do tell someone, then, yeah, they're going to probably die in a scene or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So Anne believes him. You know, we don't do this bullshit of, oh, no, it's not that. Like, love we're it. Not denying it. But also she just immediately is like, okay, I'm in. What are we going to do about this? So we start making a plan. And unfortunately, this is where we see the Detective Hammond, who is played by John Doucette, has been eavesdropping. He doesn't know exactly what's going on, but he saw this whispered conversation. So he tells Detective Hennessy, we got to keep an eye on this. Something weird is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So that night, Guy calls Bruno and he says, you know what? The time has come. I've got the gun. I've got the note. I've got the key. I'm going to come. I'm going to kill your father. So he goes out the back fire escape. He ditches his surveillance crew. He gets over to the Antony house. He gets past the guard dog. I do love the sequence with the dog. And he finds not Mr. Antony waiting in bed, but Bruno.
This was fantastic. But also, what would Bruno have done if he actually just like started stabbing into the bed?
Well, he's there with the gun, not with the knife.
Oh, I'm sorry. What would Bruno have done if he just started shooting into the bed?
I mean, yeah, I guess he'd just be dead, wouldn't he?
But I guess that shows, you know, he knows he's not going to do it.
Yeah, this is playful, right? This is a game where it's almost as if Bruno is saying, okay, well, I dare you. No, I was willing to take the risk that you might shoot me, but also I kind of knew that you wouldn't, and now we get to have this confrontation.
But I also like at the same time, though, that Guy doesn't back down here. So instead of being like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, blah, 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 he says, mm-hmm. Well, I thought your dad would be interested to know he has a lunatic for a son.
Yeah. Not to backtrack too far, but the scene where Guy gets past the guard dog of the house. Yeah. So Savage says, when Guy enters Bruno's home, the seemingly vicious dog licks his hand. It's as if the canine recognizes Guy. It is interesting to note that Guy is carrying a gun, even though he has no intention of killing Bruno's father, but this gun functions more as a phallic symbol rather than a plot device. So there's kind of two interesting points going on there. One is this interchangeability of the two men. So like recognizes like, the dog is like, oh, here's another queer in the house. I guess I'll just lick my master's hand. And then also, you know, Guy approaching what is eventually revealed to be Bruno in bed waiting for him with this phallic gun.
Oh my God. I'm surprised Bruno's not just in full drag, like wearing a woman's clothes and wig.
I mean, I think he's in his colorful robe, isn't he?
I mean, he's definitely making a show out of it, like every queer should.
Okay, so Bruno gets pretty upset when Guy says he's not going to kill his father and he never planned to. So Guy doesn't back down, you're right, but he is like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to leave. And this is when Bruno promises revenge. So he's following Guy with the gun on him throughout the entire house. And even though I didn't ever really fear for Guy's life,
but it is scary.
It is scary. It's actually quite tense.
Yes, because we constantly just have this image of Bruno like behind him or above him because Guy's going down the stairs. And yeah, it's I like you. I didn't think he was actually going to shoot him, but it's still like suspenseful.
And it's the kind of interaction that you would think, oh, is this the climax? Because typically this is how we would do it, right? Like we're getting everybody's cards on the table. We're having people speak their truths and so on. And it's not. We still have a long way to go.
We got a carousel to get on.
Oh my God. We've got a tennis match to play. So the next day, Anne speaks with Miss Antony. This is where she goes and says, so your son definitely committed a murder and you should try to address it. And this woman is in complete denial.
But I just, that was a practical joke. Again, this is a scene that I didn't expect because I didn't expect Anne to have this much agency, to go straight to the lion's den.
Yeah, because she too realizes, okay, well, we can't go to the cops because they're definitely not going to believe you and I'm not going to be able to sway them. But as a society woman, I can go and speak to the mother and see if we can just make this stop.
Yes.
And this mother is just as delusional. Like, she's not going to be any help at all.
But that's okay. Do you think that she is just aloof and daffy, or do you also think she's just as psychotic as Bruno is?
I think she knows that there's something wrong with her son, but she doesn't want to address it. So for her, it's painting and happy times.
Yeah. I mean, she does say he sometimes gets terribly irresponsible and gets to all kinds of escapades.
Yes. Escapades.
Escapades, quote unquote.
My dear, he strangled a woman with his bare hands a couple nights ago.
He's fine.
He's fine.
I mean, he has designs to blow up the White House, but that he didn't go through with that. So, again, he's fine.
I mean, it makes you wonder how many times they've maybe gone through this with Bruno, where people say, oh, you know, he told me these tall tales. Oh, OK, well, it's not that big of a deal because he's done this before. So after Miss Antony leaves, Bruno reveals himself. He's at home. So we get this scene between him and Anne, and I will say, as much as I like it, I wish it had have gone further or continued, because he does this whole thing where he says, are you sure you can trust Guy? Because I'm pretty sure he was the one who was on the island. I'm pretty sure he's the one who left the lighter. He's planting these suspicions in Anne's mind. And credit to her, she doesn't fall for it for even a second. But I kind of wish that we had pursued this. Like, ooh, Bruno is so... he's so convincing. Suave, you know, because for a hot moment, it does look like she's uncertain.
Yeah, and maybe if she was the main character, we would have more of that.
Mm-hmm.
Man. But that being said, I'm surprised we have this meet between them, because wasn't expecting Anne to have any kind of agency, especially in front of Bruno.
Mm-mm. Yeah, you think, okay, the girlfriend now knows, so that's fine. We don't have to worry about that.
Right.
I didn't expect her and Babs to become integral players in moving this plot along.
Uh-huh, absolutely. And that's why it's like, you know, when you hear about, you know, Hitchcock being mean to Ruth Roman, you're kind of like, oh, but like, I like her character.
Yeah, I mean, Anne's not really doing too much in terms of characterization, but like, she's definitely a key player in this movie, and I think that the actor is doing good stuff. You know, it's not the most exciting, but it's doing what it needs to.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so after this interaction, Anne goes to meet with Guy. They're talking about the murder and what they're going to do about it. Right in the middle of fucking open, like, we're about to go and play tennis, and they're talking about it at regular volume with a bunch of people walking around behind them.
Well, and here's the thing. So this tennis match should not be suspenseful.
No.
But it is. So, okay, what Hitchcock decides to do with his editor, William H. Ziegler, is he decides to intercut the tennis match with a similar scene, well, not a similar scene, but just another scene, of Bruno dropping the lighter down this sewer grate and having to get it. And so, and what's fun is, too, Dimitri Tiomkin's score changes every time we cut to the different things, because we have kind of a darker, more menacing score for Bruno and not for Guy. But we're going back and forth so often that the changes in score are almost seamless. But yeah, so we have Guy who's like, I want to make this match end quickly so I can get to the island. But oops, of course, the match goes on for a very, very, very long time. And then Bruno drops this lighter and he wants to get it, going so far as to like call the police to be like, I have to get this lighter, dude.
Yeah, it's too funny. It's dropped down a storm drain, and they basically say, you got to write this off. There's no way you're going to be able to get it. They're just going to tell you the same thing if you try to call anybody. And yeah, so we just get these close-up shots of his fingertips grazing the lighter. He tries to get a little closer. He starts to grab it. It falls and so on. This sequence goes on forever. So long.
And I'm a sucker for those shots where it's like, oh yeah, your fingers are like an inch away from the item you're trying to get. Like, just reach a little bit further.
Yeah, get a stick with a piece of gum on it. Come on. Here's the thing. This shouldn't work. There's nothing particularly exciting. Like, we're reaching for a lighter and we're playing a game of tennis. And I will say, I do think it goes on just a little too long. I would have trimmed this back just a touch, but it is really effective. Like, my pulse is pounding, and these are just innocuous events.
I think the cross cutting adds to the suspense, though, because if you just showed these two scenes in sequence, I think it would be boring.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. So, of note, when Bruno is going for this lighter, Nicholson says, while we despise and fear Bruno and do not wish him to succeed in framing Guy, the good guy in the film, we do find ourselves tensing with eagerness as Bruno struggles to get his hands on the fallen lighter. We want him to retrieve it. Morally, we don't want him to succeed, but dramatically, we're straining with him to do just that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, my eyes are straining as his hand is.
So, yeah, as you said, Guy needs to win this tennis match so that we can beat Bruno to the island. I will confess, I struggled to piece together why Guy thought if he got there first, he was going to be able to do something. Like, we know that Bruno is going to drop off the lighter and frame Guy for the murder, but I don't know how Guy getting there first would have helped.
I wonder if then he could spot Bruno coming in and then grab the lighter after he dropped it off.
Right, or maybe just confront him who knows. So he needed to get there first, but as you said, the tennis match goes on forever. Thankfully, we do have Babs and Anne looking out for him, so we've got a cab waiting at the ready. We've got a change of clothes so that we can get Granger changing in the back of the cab. And also, we've delayed Hennessy so that we can make an escape and not be followed. Because, of course, you can't be seen at the scene of the crime collecting a piece of evidence.
Okay, but big laugh for me, though, is because so we have this kind of car chase as a guy makes his way to the island. And Hennessy and his cop partner get in this car with this woman. And she's like, we have to borrow your car. We're chasing a criminal. And she's like, oh, really? How exciting.
Yes. Another little moment of comedy, right?
I love it.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, we also have Bruno. He's actually managed to get to the island first, but he is trying to avoid the attention of the boatman who notices him, starts to recognize him. So, again, we're starting to build the tension back up. Who's going to get recognized? Who's going to get in trouble first?
Yeah. But, Joe, we can't just end this movie in a carnival. What are we? Where do we have to go?
Oh my God. Yeah. So everything builds to this fight on the carousel. And because the police have arrived, they think they've got their man and he's tried to ditch them. So obviously we need to shoot. And what we accidentally do is we shoot at the person who is controlling the carousel and they put it into more or less hyperdrive.
I mean, it's like a Gravitron, but on an open carousel. Joe, when I tell you I wasn't expecting something like this in this movie, I mean, this is awesome.
It's amazing. Obviously, this is regular film that we've sped up, so everything is a little bit herky-jerky initially, but that's just until we actually get the camera onto the carousel. We should note, it's not as though the park is deserted and these are the only characters here. This is heavily populated. So we have a woman whose child is on the carousel and she is not. We have lovers on there. We've got just a bunch of people who are in the mix. And this carousel is picking up so much speed that when they try to jump on it, the police just immediately get thrown back off.
Oh, I mean, there's a shot of Farley Granger like hanging on to one of the bars as he is like hanging off the edge of this carousel. It is wild. And the way Hitchcock did this, so he took a toy carousel and he photographed it blown up by a small charge of explosives.
Oh my God.
The piece of film he then enlarged and projected onto a vast screen, positioning actors around it and in front of it so that the effect is one of a mob of bystanders into which the plaster horses and passengers are hurled in deadly chaos. But also, hey, the other shot in this that I was like, this is really impressive, is the one of the guy crawling under the carousel to try to turn it off.
I needed a second. So I rewatched this scene a second time because I was so fucking impressed. And honestly, the first time I was just watching it, I wrote like carousel goes wild. And then I just stopped taking notes because I had to just watch it. And I could not figure out how they did this. This is actually just, this is a projection. So we've got the actor crawling and we've already filmed the out of control sequence. You can see a little bit of like the blurring where the actor goes under. It is so fucking good, though. Like, it took me the second viewing to spot it.
The overhead, the carousel that's over his head was actually there, though. And Hitchcock is on record as saying this was one of the only times where he was scared on a film shoot, because the shot of this man crawling under the carousel, if he had, like, moved, you know, even an inch up, it could have taken his scalp off.
Oh my gosh. And the funniest thing is that we're still introducing comedic bits. So there's a moment, you know, like we're going to talk about a couple of parts in this sequence. But this dude, he volunteers. He says, I can crawl under there. I can come up around the platform to the center, which isn't rotating, and I'll stop the ride. And the cops are like, OK, you go, because we don't know what we're doing. And we see him crawling. And there's a moment where he just pauses so he can take out his handkerchief and wipe his sweaty brow.
Oh my God.
And then he just puts it back. And I don't know if it's meant to be funny, but I definitely guffawed. Because the urgency, like, up top, what we're actually seeing is, like, this woman whose child is on the carousel and she's screaming for her child. This child nearly goes flying off. It's only because Guy manages to catch him and plunk him down in a car that this kid doesn't just go skidding off into the abyss.
Is this the same kid that's, like, actually, like, trying to beat on a Bruno when they're having this fight?
Yes.
Okay, yes. I was like, good for this kid, but oh my God, this kid's gonna go flying.
We've got women just desperately grabbing these horses to prevent themselves from getting blown off. And then we've got this full-blown fight sequence between Guy and Bruno, because, of course, we're trying to get the lighter back. And obviously, as we are apt to do when we're making queer readings of films, we end up in a horizontal position. And this is a sex scene.
Of course it is. It just happens to be on a berserk carousel.
Mm-hmm. So Nicholson says, what strikes the viewer now is that the scene of Guy and Bruno on top of each other, locked in a furious physical contact, suggests passionate lovemaking, as well as two men trying to kill each other. And the desperate whirling of the machine they are on even suggests mounting orgasmic excitement.
I mean, it ends with an explosion, so...
It does end with an explosion, and there's even these shots as they're fighting, like, again, kind of like the opening where we're on ground level, except that now we can actually see them because they are also on the ground, but our vision is continually interrupted by the rhythmic up and down motion of these horses,
yeah.
Which frankly looks like the motion you would make when you're fucking someone.
Jacking off
or just, like thrusting and pounding. So on. Like there's a moment where Bruno literally positions Guy's head so that the horse hoof is bashing him in the head. And you're like, well, I mean, it's right there, isn't it?
Just a little bit.
Yeah, so we finally stop this out of control ride. But of course, the very abrupt stopping motion basically derails this entire rotating platform. And we get this explosion. I'm convinced everyone would die.
I mean, wooden pieces of these horses would absolutely fly into many children's faces.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we see it. Like, whole sections of this ride have either been collapsed or it's been exploded. And yeah, I mean, obviously, we don't care about the other people because they were just collateral damage and it was very exciting. But who cares about them now? But we do see that Bruno has been horrifically and fatally crushed.
Well, and so apparently the choreography for all this, like Hitchcock came up with it at the 11th hour. Like, you know, they knew it was going to be a carousel thing, but it was like, how are we going to stage all of this and like whatever. But right. One good thing that it allowed them to do is it was to show Bruno dying. Because I guess originally maybe he was just going to blow up on the thing and like he was gone or dead.
Oh, okay.
With this, though, it was like, yeah, so we can show Bruno dying. And also because he's still alive at this point, we can show, oh, he's never going to give up on his intention to incriminate Guy. So even when he's dying, he's not saying it was me all along. He's like, oh, no, it was you the whole time. So
I loved it. I loved it. Again, this subversion. I totally thought he was going to say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done this. Yeah. And instead, he keeps up the facade up until the moment he does. No, Guy, it was you. I'm so sorry that you committed that murder.
It's wild. And again, I love that. Like, he is just evil to the very bitter end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other funny thing that I found here is when Guy says, oh, he's got my lighter. He was going to frame me by leaving it on the island. And he asks the lieutenant guy from earlier, he says, can I search his pockets? And the guy goes, no, you can't do that. Also, he says he didn't have your lighter. he's a liar and a blackmailer and a murderer, but absolutely. So it's good that Bruno ends up dying here, because if not, Guy definitely would have gone down for this.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, we're lucky. And granted, the way the book ends is like Guy ends up having to turn himself in because he did commit a murder.
Oh, yeah. I guess that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So I guess even in the book, it's like fine. But no, I think this is fine. I mean, again, like this carousel set piece is worth the price of admission alone. So,
oh, boy, it is a fantastic climax.
And a great end for this, like, really despicable, but like very entertaining villain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, normally we just get a kind of big fight sequence and we knock someone off a building or we shoot them or something.
Oh, yeah.
This is fun. It's just different.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I like. I never in a million years would have expected something like this in this movie.
I mean, I was just happy we got a carnival because, frankly, I fucking love a carnival.
We need way more carnival like set pieces. Absolutely. Hey, you know what? We got one in Texas Chainsaw 3D and they botched it.
Okay, that wouldn't have been my example to go to, but yes.
Ugh, God. I mean, Leatherface in a carnival.
Ugh. Yeah. But yeah, so we've got this final jokey moment on the train with Anne and Guy, but really, the movie's over.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, yeah, but I like the kind of like that we end on a joke, you know, some guy approaches Anne and Guy and they're like, no, we're not talking to you. We're going to go to the next car. Movie
yeah,
over.
We have learned our lesson. We do not talk to strangers on the train.
I really like this. I'm trying to think if I like it more than Rope or not. Do you know?
Huh. it feels like just a very different film. That movie felt a bit more like an exercise. You know, we talked at length about how technical Hitchcock approached this.
Right.
This feels looser, freer. We've said playful a couple of times. This just kind of feels like Hitchcock is in his element and he's having a good time.
Yeah, it is a thing. And you know, I don't remember exactly what we said about Roe, but it's a thing where it's like, you know, because of that gimmick where we're doing like a whole movie across 13 single takes, if that might distract from, again, the kind of fun looseness that he has in this film.
Right. Yeah.
But no, I mean, yeah, I think it's very clear that he really, like, this was a passion project for him, and it shows on screen. And again, there's so many subversions in here that I just really, really appreciated. So yeah, a great first-time watch for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, total agreement.
Well, all right, everyone, that is Strangers on a Train. And before we announce what we're covering next week, just some quick housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Twitter and Instagram at HorrorQueers. Shoot us an email at HorrorQueers@gmail.com. Find us on Letterboxd, keep track of all the films we've covered. If you want to chat with other listeners, please join our Facebook Horror Queers group. We would love it if you would rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That's always very helpful. But if you want even more content, please support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/horrorqueers. If you subscribe today, you will get 292 hours of Patreon content, including this month's new episodes on Hannibal Season 1, Episode 3, Imaginary, Immaculate, Love Lies Bleeding, and our audio commentary for the month will be on Rennie Harlan's Mindhunters.
Oh my goodness.
But Joe.
Mm-hmm.
What? Oh my god. What are we talking about next week?
Well, as threatened / promise, it has been 2 years, Trace, since we covered the first Scooby-Doo movie, so... We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed.
And the monsters will be unleashed, and you've got Alicia Silverstone to look forward to, baby.
Ooh, okay. Well, you know what? That just increases my excitement then.
We'll see if you like it. I don't think you will, but I will be happy to be proven wrong. But yes, until next week, everyone, we can cross out Strangers on a Train.
Indeed. And cross out Horror Queers.